Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with plain snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the February 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about the Manic Street Preachers. And then a book review, Before Elvis, the African-American Musicians Who Made the King. And a classic album review of one of my favorites, Around the World in a Day by Prince. And I begin with the article about the Manic Street Preachers titled A Curse Against Elegies. Manic Street Preachers have survived tragic loss, cultural upheaval, and relentless self-scrutiny to arrive at a 15th album that acknowledges their precarious place in the world. Other rock bands wouldn't be as exacting, but they are not other rock bands. We've never ever allowed ourselves to be deluded, they tell Dorian Linsky. Every Manic Street Preachers album comes with a tone-setting quotation. On their latest, Critical Thinking, the American poet Anne Sexton does the honors. I am a collection of dismantled almost. Many artists fret about their mortality and waning power, but perhaps nobody else would advertise their concerns so loudly. I know our time has come and gone, James Dean Branfield declares on the perversely exhilarating first single, Decline and Fall, but at least we blazed a trail and shone. And there's a little bit of the song, Decline and Fall, by the Manic Street Preachers. Then again, the group were dwelling on defeat, even at their commercial high noon. Their 1998 album, This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours, greeted its 5 million listeners with The Everlasting. In the beginning, when we were winning, when our smiles were genuine, the Manic Street Preachers suffer from a kind of musical hypochondria, forever expecting an end that never arrives. There's a truth serum in the band that has served us very well, says Nicky Wire, the band's bassist, lyricist, sometimes singer, self-appointed curator, and pitiless autocritic. We've never ever allowed ourselves to be deluded. Failure is ingrained in the band as much as success. The biggest piss take we have is we get in the studio and James will shout out, sounding better than ever, because we know we're not really. It's a lie. He smiles sadly. The reality is managed decline. That's one way of looking at it. Another angle is that this is a story of extraordinary resilience and consistency. If not for the disappearance of guitarist and lyricist Richie Edwards in 1995, he was officially pronounced dead in 2008, and the death of manager Philip Hall in 1993, little would have changed in terms of personnel. Wire, Branfield, and drummer Sean Moore, Bradford's cousin, are still managed by Hall's brother, Martin. They have been working with producer Dave Eringa in some capacity for 34 years and remain signed to Columbia after 33. They've never split up or even gone on hiatus. Branfield starts thinking about the next album as soon as he's finished mastering the last. He compares it to consistently running for re-election. Probably, we are a bit underappreciated because we've never stopped, says Wire. It's the curse of being overly productive. This is our 15th studio album plus solo albums. Greatest hits, reissues. There's an album every 2 years, basically, and the first four came in 4 years, with a manager dying and Richie disappearing. It's like some 60s band, isn't it? Their music, at least, is always changing. Heroic arena rock, bruising post-punk, acoustic, soul-searching, bittersweet, M.O.R. Each album reacts against its predecessor. Wire maintains that Branfield's musical dexterity is criminally underrated. The bassist writes improbable combinations of lacing autobiography, contrarian social commentary, art appreciation, and history. Then Branfield and Moore give them melodic wings. You've got to listen to what the words are telling you, says Bradford. It's okay to feel intimidated by a lyric. It's roughly 40 years since Wire and Bradfield started writing songs together. In their last year at Oaksdale Comprehensive in Blackwood, South Wales, aftermath about the miners' strike was followed by lots of songs about girls, Wire recalls. They considered calling their band Intellectual Monks. We had to give ourselves the joy of at least feeling intellectually superior because we were social non-identities. We were the worst people in the school. But Bradfield, for Bradfield, that was the first of many watersheds that convinced him he was on the right track. I found that when we wrote our first song together, when Richie played with us for the first time, and it felt perfect. I remember when we did Motown Junk, thinking, we're a real band. I remember when Nick and Richie gave me Motorcycle Emptiness. At all those pivotal moments, you know the band is the best place, so you don't want to let it go. And here's some of that song, Motorcycle Emptiness, by the Manic Street Preachers.
Travel war.
The Manic Studio, Door to the River, is a converted house with a view of green hills rolling down towards the Newport skyline. Its Cardoff predecessor, Faster, was demolished and replaced with flats several years ago. A metaphor too far, perhaps. In the airy lounge near the dartboard and the Dyson hang scrappy collages of inspiration. John Lydon and Lana Del Rey, alongside Philip Larkin and Marilyn Monroe. At the top of the stairs, a glass frame immortalizes Edward's fur-lined black jacket from 1991's You Love Us video. The band became acquainted with grief at an unreasonably early age. These days, it is a regular visitor. Wire lost his beloved parents, one after the other. Steve Albini, producer of 2009's Journal for Plague Lovers, passed away in May. The last song Mark Lanegan worked on before his death in 2022 was the Manics' Blank Diary entry. New song, My Brave Friend, turns the passing of their product manager, Jim Fletcher, into a broader exploration of loss. With a grim laugh, Branfield calls this time of life Sniper's Alley. The answer, as always, is to keep working. In the past 18 months, on top of Critical Thinking and a world tour with Suede, Wire has released a solo album, staged an exhibition of Polaroid art, and started to book that he refuses to call a memoir. It has been easy, though. It hasn't been easy, though. However vibrant and often beautiful, Critical Thinking has a divided soul, three songs entirely written and sung by Bradfield, and three by Wire. The bassist considered calling it the Dialectics, very pretentious, because there's a sense of opposing forces on this record. It's not the last gang in town. There were separate recording sessions. There were arguments. There's no more destructive bloke in the world than a 55-year-old who thinks he's right, Wire says ruefully. There's been times when I've felt like I'm irritating everyone, including myself, and maybe I shouldn't put them through the pain. It's important to know that Wire says things like this with a mile-wide grin and a generous laugh. Accentuated along a sofa, plucking his sunglasses on and off, he will frequently maintain that he is a difficult and unpleasant person while being immensely charming. It's hard to square the words with their delivery. I'm fascinated with my inner workings, he elaborates. I've never been bored, but over the last 2 or 3 years, I went off myself a bit, which was a bolt from the blue. I came to the end of the road. Later, he emails to clarify, I fear work has become a deflection rather than a reflection, that the dots will never join again. This state of fracture is permanent. When James Dean Bradfield takes his seat, the energy shifts. He sits up, leans in, talks a blue streak, and buzzes like an electric coil. He hates to overanalyze the band or himself, lest he becomes a pretentious fuckhead. But he's no less astute. When he was in danger of blowing his A-levels, his mom told him his worst enemy was laziness. It stuck with me forever, like an echo in my head, he frowns. I'm governed by battling my own laziness, so it makes me quite frantic. There must be a story behind Sean Moore's dramatic transformation on the last tour. Burly, bearded, tattooed. But he's currently snubbing interviews and remains a mystery, even to his cousin. I can't unlock Sean, Bradfield admits, throwing up his hands. I've known him all my life, and I don't know how he views the world. The polarities of critical thinking are extreme. Bradfield's radiant being baptized draws solace from an almost spiritual encounters with the late Alan Toussaint in 2011, while Wire puts himself through the ringer on the glittering Hiding in Plain Sight. And here's some of the song Hiding in Plain Sight by the Manic Street Preachers.
There is a trap that fails. Saw a portrait of myself. Made a promise to be kept. Yes, the procession is long, but the time is very short. Leave the traces far behind for the future one.
I want to be in love with the man I used to be. He wants to be a better person, says Bradfield, which is mad because he's lived his life in an impeccable way. I think Nick writes to understand what he's feeling, but I don't know if he does it to soothe himself. While the Manics first burst out of Wales in 1990, they were hymning Guns N' Roses, Public Enemy, and The Clash. But it's clearer than ever that their musical bedrock is 1980s alternative rock, from The Cure and The Associates to REM and 10,000 Maniacs. So many records from the 80s unlock emotions in me, says Bradfield. It's created a shadow on my frontal lobe that will never go away. It makes me feel like I'm free again. In 1984, the Smiths played Cardiff University. Wire's mom wrote to them explaining that her son was desperate to come, but was too ill. The whole band wrote back, "Get well soon, Nick," scribbled Morrissey, rediscovering the postcard, almost a spiritual antique, prompted Wire to reopen the correspondence with Dear Stephen, a tender reckoning with teenage fandom and adult disappointment. There is less warmth on the spiky title track, A Gang of Four style. Wire rant against the self-help industry. The phrase, be your authentic self, he spits. I mean, what a clamorous fucking idea. What do you think all the dictators and rapists are doing? They're being their authentic selves. My authentic self is a cunty gobshite. He has his own unorthodox techniques. Wires Mindfulness, he laughs, is 127 episodes of Real Dictators with Paul McGann. I don't know what that says about me. The maniac's imperial phase was remarkable. In the midst of tragedy, they went from the black hole intensity of 1994's The Holy Bible to the jukebox popularism of 1996's Everything Must Go in One Move. The title track said it all. Freed from the memory, escape from our history. There was too much at stake all the time. Bradfield remembers. Everything was so loaded. Then the Richie thing happened, and we thought, phew, this is a heavy load being in a band. And it shouldn't be. Everything has got to stop meaning so much. We need to just fly and breathe and leave some of this behind. Propelled by the stirring majesty of A Design for Life, the album went triple platinum, turning the maniacs into the proper rock stars they always dreamt of being. And here's a little bit of that song, A Design for Life, by the Manic Street Preachers.
Life was gave us power. Then what came and made us free? What price now for a shallow piece of dignity? I wish I had.
Finally remembers meeting Kylie Minogue and Miners leader Arthur Scargill in quick succession and touring America with Oasis. They were virtually splitting up every gig, but we were on a nice even keel, really, for the first time. Bradfield says he had three conflicting reactions to success. The first thought was that he loved it. I loved playing in front of big crowds. I loved seeing the febrile flame keepers mix with the Mondo drivers. I loved the idea that A Design for Life was across the airways and the lyrics said what they said. That's what we were made for. But sometimes he wondered if critics were right to denounce them as hypocritical sellouts. And the third way was imposter syndrome. I kept thinking, is this really happening to us? What's going on? It was confusing, but I enjoyed it. In the quiet spaces between the hits, This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours, was strangely dejected, but it sold even more. The Maniacs, two fabulously provocative UK number one singles about war and class. If you tolerate this, Your Children Will Be Next, and The Masses Against the Classes, dethroned Boisantine and Westlife respectively. Amazingly, they had Tolerate down as a B-side before Wisdom Prevailed. They spent the final hours of the 20th century headlining Cardiff's Millennium Stadium, but something had gone awry, says Brandfield. I remember Nick watching film of us at Glastonbury and saying, "It's all wrong. You're acting when you're singing," he laughs. He was quite disgusted with the way I was gestulating. I don't think I was doing mime or anything, and I thought, "Oh God, what have I become?" The next album, he decided, would need Blood on the Tracks. In the end, there was rather too much blood on 2001's Know Your Enemy. Launched with a quixotic show in Havana, attended by Fidel Castro, this noisy, unwieldy album removed them from the top table. Bradfield insists it was his fault for insisting this big melange should be one album instead of two, but Wire blames himself. "It's me saying we're not going to be the Welsh U2. It's not in our DNA to be this big." It was a giant act of self-sabotage. I can't pretend I didn't know, because people were looking at me going, "But why? What's the point in that?" I think I was on a downward spiral. Bradfield isn't sure their popularity was sustainable anyway. This is not a self-effacing thing, but we did have one problem in trying to keep that upward curse going, and that's me. He holds up his hand in forestall disagreement. "It's me. Radiohead have Thom, Blur have Damon, Pulp have Jarvis." You can imagine all those singers being personalities in another realm. With me, it's harder. I am the Unitarian ditch digger that got put at the front of the band. The sleek, sad Lifeblood, 3 years later, was another left turn in chewing all their rock and roll brawn. They have described both albums as catastrophes, though they've since come around to their awkward charms via revisionist reissues. Wire thinks this period of flight and confusion made the muscular arena rock comeback of 2007's Send Away the Tigers all the sweeter. It probably needed a heavy dose of failure to really enjoy it again, because we had the best time. We'd be supporting Bob Dylan in a stadium in Croatia, and he'd ask us to do it. He thinks they probably should have gone straight into 2010's similarly big and bombastic Postcards from a Young Man. But Bradfield wanted to make Journal for Plague Lovers, the Albany-produced quasi-sequel to The Holy Bible, which honored Edwards' final cachet of lyrics. "That was a fucking curveball," says Wire. "Artistically, we gained, but commercially, we threw people off the scent again." It was while writing 2013's bleakly autumnal and profoundly Welsh Rewind the Film that Wire says he began to cross the line separating melancholy from despair. Even for his famously self-critical lyricist songs like Running Out of Fantasy and This Sullen Welsh Heart, "I don't want my children to grow up like me. We're brutal. I find it quite difficult to listen to," he admits. That was the start of feeling like you'd lost your place. You'd had your second act when you're just waiting, yet simultaneously they were recording the thrillingly forward-looking Euro travelogue Futurology. It was a revealing, conflicting pairing. We're finished, we're back. Bradfield has learned to let the bad days go. Sometimes I do wish Ricky was around, he says, so I could say a song is valid for that moment in time. But you don't have to live your life like a song. The Manic Street Preachers fan base these days is a strange mix, says Bradfield. More people have done dissertations on us than have formed bands from us. We have lots of people who work in local government and the NHS, lots of coppers, quite a lot of priests. Postcards from a Young Man was billed as one last shot at mass communication, and so it proved for them and for nonconformist rock bands in general. It's not as if the comparably intelligent and audacious Fountains D.C. are touching the UK top 40 either. For the Manics, who grew up seeing their favorite cult bands crash the mainstream and then become one of them, that's a cultural loss. That generation isn't going to have that moment, says Wire. It was just a fluky time in the 90s. He's not surprised the Oasis reunion became a national event. There's a sense of jeopardy to that period. If you bottle things up too much, then you look to a time when you think, oh, they just did and said what they wanted. We were so lucky to start the band when we did, says Bradfield, but we've been watching it all disappear, the venues, the record shops, the music press. It kills me. I resent that music has been taken to the broadsheets and the South Bank. Musicians have got to theorize about everything they do. They can't just be a nutter. The father of two sights, sometimes you've got to admit that the times are not yours anymore. The Manics have also retreated from the political front lines. In songs and interviews, they foresaw the rise of white right-wing popularism and the corrupting influence of big tech. Wire bored people shitless going on about it. But in the tumultuous area of Brexit, Trump, Corbyn, and online poison, they were relatively quiet. Bradfield confesses with a pained expression that he didn't vote in the Brexit referendum. It was the first time in my life that I didn't feel like anyone deserved my vote, which is quite a pious, self-important thing to decide. I admit that was a big mistake. I felt a little bit ashamed. I had this tantrum in my head. It was a symptom of the band's political confusion. I think we withdrew, says Wire. There wasn't an answer. I think if you stop believing in yourself, it's hard to believe in anything else. Wire can still nail the times in a couplet, though, like this one from Deleted Scenes, the ecstasy of making things worse seems to have become a worldwide curse. In the same song, he writes, I fear myself more than anything else, the power at my fingertips. It's about the power to self-immolate on social media, he explains, snapping his fingers, just like that. I worry I have the destructive tendency to actually enjoy doing it. If you're seeking oblivion, it feels like an attractive proposal at times. Yet, at the same time, if we're talking dialects, he still wakes up every day and thinks, I'm the luckiest person on earth. He had an inspirational family growing up. He has Rachel, his wife of 31 years, and two fiercely bright children. And he has the band. I genuinely love Manic Street Preachers, he says, with total conviction. I love listening to our music. I shudder reading our interviews, but I still enjoy them. I don't love myself so much, that's true, but I love the band. Okay, now I'm moving on to a book review titled How Great Thou Art. The stories of Arthur Big Boy, Crudup, Big Mama Thornton, and more move Danny Extelson. Before Elvis, the African-American musicians who made the king. That Elvis Presley rock revolution was built on raw materials mostly learned from black blues, gospel, and R&B artists will be news to no one. But luckily, that's only the starting point of Preston Lauterbach's illuminating study. In pooling the lives and careers of Presley's key influences, among them Arthur Big Boy Crudup, whose version of That's All Right began Presley's ascent, and Big Mama Thornton, whose Hound Dog rocket powered it, he frees them from the files of the ripped off and victimized, although they were those things too, and affords them their own agency. Crudup, for one, emerges as a progenitor shifter of units in his own right. In 1949, notes Lauterbach, his That's All Right was already such a staple that when 45 RPM disc debuted, RCA reissued it on orange vinyl to hype the format. Here's a little bit of the song That's All Right from Arthur Big Boy Crudup.
Well, now that's all right, now, mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, now, mama. Any way you do, but that's all right. That's all right. That's all right now, mama. Any way you do. Well, my mama, she done told me. Papa told me, too. The life you live in, son, now women be the death for you. But that's all right. That's all right.
Neither is it a surprise to learn that the impact of Presley's success on those he channeled was both too little and too late. But the details are sobering. Crudup heard Elvis's version of That's All Right on a jukebox in Franktown, Virginia, and wrote to Lester Melrose, the white controller of his publishing, asking if he'd heard it too. Melrose wrote back, saying indeed he had, but failed to mention the royalty checks he had been receiving on Crudup's behalf. In 1993, after they bought out Melrose, Presley's publishers, Hill and Range, were approached by Crudup, but they refused to settle. The singer's family would not see a penny until 1975. The year Chappelle Music bought Hill and Range, by which time Crudup was dead and one of his sons in jail for robbery. The charge could hardly be more ironic. Mixed fortunes were the lot of other key influences. Guitarist Calvin Newborn, whose pink suit and hip gyrations Elvis had clocked at shows in the early 50s, hitched to the rising star of his jazz pianist brother, Phineas Jr., before being drafted in 1957. His subsequent career included a stint with Sun Ra, but music rarely paid the bills. In the 60s, dealing heroin was a more reliable occupation. Big Mama Thornton struggled to maintain a living until British and Bay Area blues boomers started singing her praises in the mid to late 60s. Janis Joplin's version of Thornton's Ball and Chain brought her more satisfaction and financial reward than she ever received via Elvis's Hound Dog. Here's some of the song Hound Dog by Big Mama Thornton.
I want everybody to know that I was the one to say, you ain't nothing but a hound dog, when snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, when snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. You told me you was high class, but I can see through that. Yes, you told me you was high class, but I can see through.
Fiery Thornton was prone to denigrate Presley, saying he refused to perform shows with her. Lauterbach is more circumspect. Presley, he writes, was fastidious in name-checking black artists, although he probably could have done more to advance their careers. The racist statement, when attributed to him, "The only thing Negroes can do for me is buy my records and shine my shoes," is impossible to substantiate. For his part, Calvin Newborn, who described Presley hanging out and eating meals with his family, remembered him as a disseminator of black music, not a thief, a cultural integrator, not appropriator. "He ate pork chops and gravy sandwiches," Newborn told Lauterbach before his death in 2018. "He was a soulful dude." The King was the big fact in Arthur Crudup's career. Junior Parker, whose mystery train Presley had homaged, appears not to have given him much thought. But it needn't remain so. Look beyond That's All Right, perhaps with the help of Bear Family's 5-disc box set, a music man like nobody ever saw, and you'll find over 100 recordings of similar richness and artistry, vehicles for Crudup's cool tenor and stinging guitar that fascinate beyond any relationship with Presley or the part they might arguably play in white rock's story. You could say the same for Thornton, Parker, and the rest. Lauterbach would surely agree that the best way to reclaim or to honor Elvis's dissidents is to listen to them. Okay, here's an article, a short article about the band ELO. Could it be Farewell, ELO? Jeff Lynn explains. Of all the gigs to see in 2025, one bittersweet experience will be the final show ever by Electric Light Orchestra, part of the BST concert series at London's Hyde Park. The famous ELO Flying Saucer will land one last time on July 13th for the climax of the world jaunt aptly named the Over and Out Tour. The voyage goes all the way back to 1972, when leader Jeff Lynne played his first gigs with the band. After the group's dissolution in 1986, with some false starts around the millennium, the group's mastermind fully refitted the band for touring after establishing Jeff Lynne's ELO in 2014. Now comes the farewell that was originally planned for 2020, but which was derailed by COVID. It will certainly be an emotional show for me, Lynne tells Mojo, adding, it has been great getting to tour the world, and to this day, at every show, I am always surprised and delighted by the crowds and the energy they bring. I will miss it. U.S. dates last year presented all the hits, drawing mainly on ELO's 70 heyday, with an all-killer climax of Shine a Little Love, Don't Bring Me Down, Telephone Line, and Mr. Blue Sky. Here's some of that song, Mr. Blue Sky by ELO. Playing all the songs the fans want to hear, Lynne says. As for surprises, these are the final shows, so who knows what can happen. While Lynne will be 77 when he plays Hyde Park dates in Birmingham and Manchester precede the climatic London date, he stresses it's not the end of the story, and that more music will come, though whether that's new ELO releases or productions for other people, he isn't sane. He also politely sidesteps questions about an ELO musical or a technically assisted rebirth like ABBA's Voyage. I am happy with what I've done, and the crowd reactions to the shows and the music have been amazing, he says. This is not a farewell to music. I am excited to return to the studio full time, which is what I love. Here's a little bit of the song Evil Woman by ELO.
The broken dreams have got to
The classic album review this week is Around the World in a Day by Prince. Yes, Prince was one of the biggest stars in popular music. Back in popular music, back in 1984, with the project Purple Rain, both the film and classic soundtrack, he was able to go completely mainstream. Everything about the project was phenomenal. The fashion, the sound, the style, and, most importantly, the music. But the following year, Prince just had to push the envelope. the album Purple Rain was still on the charts, selling millions of copies. But everyone wanted a sequel. Everyone who enjoyed Purple Rain and were expecting a sequel got Around the World in a Day. When I first listened to this album, I asked myself if Prince had a bad acid trip. The trippy album art was equivalent to the Beatles' 1967 recording, Sgt. Pepper's. The production was more glossy, and his sound was just completely different. It just wasn't raw and edgy anymore. The title track, Around the World in a Day, is a Middle Eastern-like song with him doing a quirky meditation. And here's a little bit of that song, Around the World in a Day by Prince. Park, which is named after his recording studio, is a psychedelic utopian track with Prince doing a lot of strange yet emotional imagery. And here's some of that song, Paisley Park by Prince. Condition of the Heart is probably one of Prince's best ballads. This song starts with a brief symphonic sound, bite, and then goes into an infectious piano line, with him singing some touching lyrics about a girl that is in love. And here's some of that song, Condition of the Heart. Raspberry Beret is one of those songs everyone should at least recognize on this album. It's one of those commercial-sounding campfire songs with everything you would love in a pop song. And the special part about it is that he mixes some Sgt. Pepper and Pet Sounds influences with his sound and creates a brilliant piece of art. He also sings some funny yet weird imagery in the song. It's just the climax of the album. Here's some of that song, Raspberry Beret by Prince. With this album, he took the riskiest challenge in mixing his sound to the 1960s psychedelia sound. No one in the 1980s had ever heard an album so creative and unique. That just showed the influential artist doing something different. It was a backlash to many fans who loved the stunning Purple Rain album. But it was a tremendous effort. It is definitely worth a listen, especially if you have a good pair of quality headphones. I would definitely agree with that, headphones or not. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I read articles from the most current March 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about Ringo Starr and his new country album, and then an article about Jesse Ed Davis and a classic album review of another favorite of mine, Haraja by Joni Mitchell. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
Built like she was, she had to learn to ask me my plan to do her any harm. So look here, I put on